taken under advisement, and we will proceed to the fifth case, Matthews versus the City of East St. Louis. Mr. Dvorak.
May it please this court, Richard Dvorak on behalf of the plaintiffs in this matter. Your Honors, I first want to start off by saying what this case is not about, because I think there's an attempt by the defense to paint it as reliance by an officer on a single credible witness and therefore immune from liability under Section 1983. And I would emphasize that is not what this case is about, because all the cases that I cited to in my brief, and which is standard textbook law, is that it still has to be reasonable. And there has to be reasonable investigations and reasonable use of judgment and reasonable looking at exculpatory evidence. So what I'd like to do for a very brief moment is just focus on the unreasonableness of it, or at least how a jury could find it was unreasonable. And I'm not going to get into all the facts, because obviously there's numerous, but a few salient facts, I think, show how this was unreasonable. One, according to the plaintiff's version of events, that Lieutenant Anderson showed up to the scene, first on the scene, and announces to the entire audience that he runs this town, and other disparaging facts, asserting his authority over this scene without investigation. Officer Greenlee then approaches and sees that these plaintiffs are already in handcuffs by private security individuals. While in cuffs, the club security takes the identification, there's a complaint, and the officer does nothing. Anderson takes a camera from one of the witnesses, takes away the film right in the presence of the other officers. Officer Greenlee knows there's a video of this incident, knows there's a camera that would have captured this incident. And
let me ask you about that. How do you know the video would have captured that incident? Did anybody see the video and indicate that?
Officer Greenlee admits in his deposition that he knew there was a working camera at the time.
And how do you know what would be depicted on the video?
Because Taylor admits in his deposition, Cedric Taylor, the owner of the club, that it would have depicted this incident. It's in his deposition.
How does he know unless he's actually seen the video?
Because the camera is focused on the exact place where it happened.
Cameras can be focused, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Well, we don't know the exact answer to that question.
Sometimes somebody's in front of the lens and interferes with what might be seen and so forth. It's hard to know until you actually see the video what's on there.
And that's my point, Your Honor. And the point is that the officer had it, knowing that there were video cameras pointed right in this incident, I believe it's reasonable, at least a jury should be able to find it's reasonable, to allow him to then go look at that video. We don't know what it depicts because he never looked at it.
So,
he never preserved it.
So unless an officer scrutinizes the video from every conceivable angle that a video camera might be, he has not conducted a sufficient investigation?
I'm not saying every conceivable angle. Just knowing that there's a camera right on the area where it happens, you should look at that camera.
So the officer has to go beyond what a complainant says and look what backs up the complainant or not or doesn't or what contradicts.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that, and certainly not in every case. I'm saying in this case, that is one of the totality of the circumstances that I think adds to the unreasonableness of it, and that should have required the officer, at least a jury should be able to find it, that the officer should have looked at this video. It's just one totality of circumstance. I'm by no means trying to enact an area of Section 1983 law where an officer has to look at the video before an arrest.
Well,
I'm by no means saying that.
Or that is a report of a melee at a bar.
Yes.
Police officer arrives, and which is perhaps common today, I'm not sure that videos exist of so many different establishments. I'll include this one. That an officer at that point, with with the potential for disturbance to continue, should take the time to examine the video before. That's got to be a reasonable component. You know, I don't know if you were here for the last argument, but Judge Tinder quite accurately talked about the next case, which is an obligation we have as well as to approach the case before us. I'm just seeing what you want to build into the requirements for what an officer ought to do coming upon a scene such as we had here.
And I'm precisely saying this is not a situation where it should be applied to all cases. I'm saying in this case, in response to Your Honor, these two people were already in cuffs. They were visibly beaten. The incident was over. Now we have to decide, okay, are we going to actually continue this arrest and prosecute? It's over.
I think the average officer would want to leave that scene with some dispatch, if he was reasonable in assessing an assault had occurred and made some judgment. I mean, are they supposed to wait at the bar while he views the video? I mean, I don't want to take judicial notice of either the scene or the venue here, but one might be concerned for the officer's safety. A prolonged attendance at such a setting.
Well, I think, first of all, the characterization of melee, I think, is inaccurate, because what we have here are three people, my clients, who were beat up and nothing more. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't characterize it a melee or put anyone in any kind of fear for their safety, and certainly Officer Greenlee
never
testified.
Well, the violence erupted over just the attendance and a question of paying.
Yes.
Cover charge, right? I mean, it sounds like a pretty tense situation, even though the numbers of individuals are slight.
I think the officers would disagree that it's a tense situation because of the way they acted and the way they behaved. And they never testified this was a tense situation that I needed to protect my safety for, nothing like that.
Wait a minute. You show up at I think it's a strip club, isn't it?
No, it's not a strip club.
Whatever. And there's been some scuffle, and people are in cuffs and so forth, and that's not a tense situation for an officer?
Well, because the alleged offender is already in custody, and he never testified that it was a tense situation. Lieutenant Anderson arrives on the scene and acts like this is my chance to shine and makes these pronouncements, while Officer Greenlee acts as an automaton and doesn't do anything. They never once testified they were in fear.
To complicate it a little more on the videotape, often those things are run by security companies, you know, and the manager of the place can't just go in and run it back himself or herself. They've got to contact the security company to come out, maybe special equipment to get it to run, and the officer has to wait for that.
But that's not. But Taylor, if you look at his deposition, Taylor testified, no, this was readily available and can be seen. I'm trying to focus on this case because I completely understand that there are cameras in probably now half of the places where there's arrests. I'm very aware of that, and that's why I'm saying in this case, that's one more totality of the circumstance that could have shown his unreasonableness to a jury. But obviously there's more. And unless there's any other questions, then move on from the videotape portion of this. We also have to consider an admission in this case, an admission by Officer Greenlee. And Greenlee's admission came through the testimony of Matthews and Gillespie in their depositions, where Greenlee, after acting like an automaton and not using any discretion whatsoever and seeing that they were obviously the victims in the case, not the offenders, then tells them, you know, this stuff happens all the time. You should really do something about it. You should file a complaint, but don't tell anyone. That shows his own admission that what he was doing was wrong. And I don't see why we wouldn't be able to, like any other case, be able to rely on an admission. Just because it doesn't come out of the words from Greenlee in a deposition doesn't mean it's not an admission. He just like an admission to a law enforcement officer, that law enforcement officer's testimony that the defendant admitted to me that he did it is an admission and can be used as evidence. Well, here we have my clients, the plaintiffs, saying, Officer Greenlee admitted to me that he knew it was unreasonable. And I think that is also a totality of circumstance that should be allowed in this case. Obviously, the bloodiness of the clothes is very relevant. Our the plaintiffs were bloodied, battered, obviously the victims of the case. Taylor didn't have a scratch on him, even though he claims to have been hit right in the face. I think that's another totality of the circumstance that should be allowed to take into consideration.
Don't people get the short end of the fight every day? And that doesn't mean, I mean, at the very least, was there a disorderly conduct probable cause?
The disorderly conduct probable cause, I'll get into later in my argument, but I'll address it right now, is the disorderly conduct, no, because there was absolutely no testimony whatsoever, no evidence whatsoever of a breach of the peace, an actual breach of the peace.
Your clients were not going to be admitted in, right?
Yes.
That was the point. They wanted in?
Well, but they, according to their version of events now, and the one that we have to rely on, they did. They thought they were going to get there free. It turned out not to be. And then they offered to pay.
And then what?
And then basically
there was an argument.
There was an argument, and it wasn't even really an argument. He testifies that the dreadlocked security employee just hauls up and hits him, and that's when they become
the security employee said something else.
Yes, but we have to rely on what the plaintiff's version event is, I believe, on this. So.
But aren't you arguing the officer had no probable cause?
Yes.
Okay.
And he didn't bother to get the plaintiff's version of events.
All right.
But in my brief I talked about how the specific statute there's no probable cause for the specific statute in this case. And again, I think that's where we get into the danger of trying to argue these closely related offenses for the first time, essentially in a reply brief, when there was no thought that this was a disorderly conduct arrest, and that's because there's a lack of evidence in the record that would support that. Defendants in their response brief essentially conceded that it would be unreasonable and there would be no probable cause to arrest two individuals for battery when the complaint from the witness was that only one person battered him. And I think fairly common sense tells us that, and the whole case law about individualized suspicion tells us that. But more importantly, silence on the issue constitutes waiver, and I cited the Blackwell case on that. Rather than addressing that issue in their response brief, and I think it would be too late now if counsel tried to do it now, they instead solely focused on the closely related doctrine. So I think it's essentially conceded, it is conceded, that there was no probable cause to arrest both of them for battery, which of course gets us then into the closely related doctrine. Which is sort of a misnomer because we no longer have to establish it's closely related, just that it's another offense. And I think I've already addressed the disorderly conduct statute and also to the reckless conduct statute talks about bodily harm and bodily safety, which is essentially the same as a battery. The problem with the battery was that there was a complaint of one person beating him up and he arrested two. It would be the same with reckless conduct in that instance.
And the same with assault. Because you don't have to strike. You can somebody can be in fear of being struck.
On an assault charge?
Yeah. So well, I get what you're saying on my reference to disorderly conduct.
And by the way, I don't know if counsel's gonna try to argue trespass. It seemed like the language he was using was talking about a trespass if they're to leave, but then in the response never argues specifically that the plaintiffs committed a violation of the trespass statute. And that's why I think the Jones and Edgerly cases are so important, because if you're going to, in a response brief, talk about the charges there was probable cause for, you have to actually say how it violated those statutes, not just sort of throw it up there that it could be a million statutes that were violated. With regard to Officer... And by the way, also, too, when I talked about the waiver, I think I missed that part. It's our contention that the defendants have waived the issue of whether or not there was probable cause in any other offense than the battery charge, which they've actually conceded there isn't, wasn't probable cause. And that's because they first raised the closely related offenses in a reply brief in the lower court. And I think Hernandez and other cases that I cited in my brief clearly talk about that's a waiver. So I think The one that was actually addressed, they've conceded by not arguing it and abandoning it, and the one that they raised on appeal, they waived because they'd first argued it in a reply brief. With regard to Officer Anderson, I think we rely on supervisory liability on there. I think the conduct of him certainly showed that he was not acting as a supervisor. He even claims he had no authority to act as a supervisor, which is obviously contrary to the 26 designated corporate representative. Monell, I would just say that it's not true to say that you first have to have officer liability. Under Thomas, causation can occur without individualized liability. And the malicious prosecution claim, we did address that in our.
I want to go back to your Monell claim. I'm confused how these hiring failures had anything to do with your underlying claim here.
Well, because I think when you have someone who's so unfit to
not unfit because of a failure to be able to or an inability to judge probable cause.
I think it is related to that because when we talk about Lieutenant Anderson, he claims he there is no authority for him to approve arrests, so he's not trained as a supervisor. He shouldn't be a supervisor. And then acts in a way that shows that he's an incompetent supervisor. And then we got Officer Greenlee, who he should have never been a police officer at the beginning because he lied about his felony arrests. Then he goes out.
So that's got nothing to do with probable cause determinations.
Well, I think it does because it shows his truthfulness, and I think his truthfulness is all part of this whole probable cause equation. However, more specifically to the probable cause issue, is that he was trained to just take anything anyone says at face value, and he believes that looking at a video is something a detective should do rather than any kind of officer. I think that's how we tie that into the causation issue.
Just one factual thing, Mr. Ford. Mr. Matthews, Mr. Gillespie, and Mr. Osafo arrived. Is there any other members of this group at that time?
Yeah, there was also a plaintiff, Dobie, who was beaten up, but he wasn't arrested, and we have a pen and state law claim.
It was four individuals who traveled to the...
Actually, no, there were more parts of the groups, but those were...
How many of them arrived at the Club Casino?
You know, I do not know the answer to that. I'm not sure if it's part of the record.
It's not evident from the record. That's fine. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hardy?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is William Hardy, and I represent the defendants' appellees of the City of East St. Louis, Officer Larry Greenlee and Officer Vincent Anderson. Your Honors, I have a few points I'd like to make during oral argument. First, I'd like to talk about this waiver issue that plaintiff's counsel has made in his reply brief and he's made here again today. He is suggesting that somehow we, as the appellees in this case, have waived the issue of whether we could argue that disorderly conduct, criminal trespass, reckless conduct, or anything of that nature supported a probable cause arrest. No case says that. The case we cited in our brief says that this court may affirm on any ground appearing in the record, regardless of whether it was relied upon by the trial court or whether it was actually considered by the trial court. Here's what happened. We filed a motion for summary judgment. In our answer, we alleged qualified immunity as a defense. In our motion for summary judgment, we said qualified immunity applied. We argued that there was probable cause for an arrest. And in response, plaintiff filed a response saying, no, there can't be probable cause for both of them to be arrested for battery. We then responded in our reply brief that, wait a minute, first of all, it can be on any related offense. Now, that's not a waiver. If this court reverses, that's a summary judgment motion. We go to trial, we're going to file a motion for a directed verdict, and we're going to say to the court, look, there was probable cause for all kinds of offenses here. The cases that plaintiff cites are cases where the appellant has waived something on appeal because the appellant didn't develop it in the trial court, or the appellant raised it for the first time in his reply brief, has nothing to do with the issue here. Now, on the issue of disorderly conduct, plaintiff's counsel argues that, look, we didn't cite anywhere in the record of a breach of the peace or that the guy was alarmed. I'm not reading the same brief, apparently. We pointed out in our statement of facts and in the argument that when Officer Greenlee arrived at the scene, here's what he saw. Two people in custody by security guards. One of them was a licensed security guard under Illinois law. No dispute about that. He just told you that they were in custody. He is then told to go to the club owner. He goes to the club owner. The club owner says to him, look, here's what happened. These guys barged in. They refused to pay. We told them they had to leave. They refused to leave. And we had to forcibly eject them from the premises. They had to force them out. And when that happened, one of the two struck him in the face. All right? Now, that fits disorderly conduct. Taylor was certainly alarmed. He was struck in the face. He was pushed. It's certainly unreasonable conduct for someone to walk in and refuse to pay, refuse to leave. There's certainly an injury. All of those requirements are met. All the requirements for trespass, all the requirements for reckless conduct. And I would suggest to you, even for assault, plaintiff's counsel says this is not about the cases that say if a single credible witness makes out a complaint, that's probable cause. It's exactly what this case is about. The cases that the plaintiffs are relying on are cases where officers at the scene make that determination. Officers at the scene make an arrest based on what they observe. Here we have a bar owner. This is and quite frankly, Your Honors, I'm offended by the arguments about Officer Greenlee and Officer Anderson. All of these facts have absolutely nothing to do with what happened at that scene. I've represented the city of East St. Louis in many cases, and I've been involved in cases where, with other police departments, where officers do things wrong. The cases of plaintiff cites are cases where the officers are arresting a meter maid who's simply trying to do her job. She's wearing a ComEd uniform. She's trying to read meters, and the officers come up and arrest her for no reason whatsoever. The cases are the Holmes case is one of the cases he's relying on. The Holmes case actually helps us. That's a case where one officer complained to another officer, look, this guy struck me. They both make out complaints. The second officer says, well, later, I was also struck, and he resisted arrest. What does the court say in Holmes? The court says, well, there's probable cause to arrest for striking the first officer, but in the second complaint, it's the officer himself who's making that determination. And they said there's a question of fact as to malicious prosecution on that claim. But the court specifically said, because the officer had probable cause that plaintiff had struck Piatek, the other officer, based on Piatek's statement, the officer of municipality could not be held liable for initiating the prosecution of plaintiff on that charge. Well, here what we have is an officer who has a complaint. He fills out the complaints. Could he have said disorderly conduct, reckless conduct? Sure, he could have. And I think plaintiff would concede that there is sufficient grounds for any number of other charges. All he's arguing is that we somehow waive that. We raised it in the trial court. In the Davenport case that the plaintiff now relies on, he's correct. And we don't have to show that they're closely related anymore. All we have to show is that there's reasonable cause, or that there's probable cause for the arrest. Now, the videotape. There's no evidence in this case that anyone ever said, look, you have to look at that videotape. Look at that videotape. Nobody said that to him. The only evidence in the record is the testimony of our officer, Greenlee, when plaintiff's counsel asked him, were you aware that there was a videotaping system? Yeah, I was aware. Did you look at the videotapes? No, I didn't. Why didn't you? That's what detectives do. Okay? He's saying it would have been reasonable for an officer to look at the videotapes. I don't dispute that it would have been reasonable. That's not the question. The question is whether it's reasonable
I guess his posture is more that it's unreasonable for him not to have done that.
Well, that's the question. The question is it unreasonable for him not to? And by the way, with respect to what Taylor testified to, he did not testify that these things were readily available. He testified that it is another company that does this recording. And when asked why he didn't make a copy of it, he said, look, I have to contact the security company. It cost me $150 to do it. It was an open and shut case. They tried to barge their way in, and I saw no reason to. But the notion that a police officer under these circumstances has an obligation in order to arrest someone when they've already received a signed complaint under oath that these individuals attempted to enter without paying, refused to leave, and were forced out, I'm not aware of any case that says that. And if this court places that kind of a burden on police officers every time they go to a bar because there's been some disturbance, it's a completely unreasonable burden. And by the way, the question clearly is, under precedent, whether it's an objective standard, whether a reasonable officer could find probable cause under these circumstances. I don't care if you believe every word that the plaintiffs say. Officer Anderson at some point said, look, this is my town. This is not Chicago. What does that have to do with whether Officer Greenlee had probable cause to arrest the plaintiffs based on a complaint signed under oath by the owner? This case is exactly where it should be now. It's in state court. It's a dispute between the plaintiffs and the club. What the plaintiffs are arguing is that we had an obligation to somehow completely investigate that. Even if we had investigated it, we'd still have the club's version, which we pointed out in our brief, which says they tried to barge in, they were forced out, and we'd have their version. If the plaintiffs wanted to make out a complaint against the club, they could have done so. Neither one of them did. There's no question about that. So, to me, it is just crystal clear that there is no basis for finding that there's a lack of probable cause in this case. And I could go through these cases that the plaintiff cites. I do want to make one point about the Edgerly case that the plaintiff mentioned and that he cited in his reply brief. The Edgerly versus City and County of San Francisco cited is 495 F3rd 645. It's a Ninth Circuit decision. Plaintiff relies on that by saying we failed to develop any argument on another criminal charge, therefore we've waived it. And in Edgerly, in that original decision, the court said there was no probable cause to arrest the plaintiff, and there were no arguments that there was developed that there was a probable cause on another offense. That decision was vacated by the court at 527 F3rd 841, and then the court issued a new opinion later on, 599 F3rd 946, where the court concluded that although the probable cause did not exist on the specific arrest on the charge of trespassing, probable cause did exist pursuant to another California statute which prohibited entering certain lands without written permission. That's the case you have to look at. And I would just reiterate again that all of these cases that the plaintiff cites are all cases where the officers themselves make those determinations. The Woods line of cases and Jenkins, they deal with a situation where a credible witness makes out a complaint. And here, it was made under oath, and it supports any number of different charges. So we would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court and remand this case with instructions to dismiss. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hardy. Mr. Park, you had no time, but you may have an additional minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Your Honor, first of all, I just want to make it clear on the videotape that Taylor testified the reason he didn't make a copy of it was because it would have to go to an outside agency. It doesn't mean that an outside agency was required to view it. As far as the fact that there was no complaint filed, that was because, according to the plaintiff's version of events, they were not allowed to even speak or say anything. So obviously they would have loved to make a complaint out, but they were not allowed to by these officers. With that, I would just ask that the judgment be reversed and remanded. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Vard.
No.
Case is taken under advisement.